Welcome to Defending Democracy, a weekly podcast from Democracy Docket. On this episode, we're discussing a major voter intimidation case in Georgia that went to court this week and involves the largest mass voter challenge in recent American history. We're your hosts. I'm Mark Elias.
And I'm Paige Moskowitz. Let's get started.
Paige, with the elections behind us, one of the nice things is we get to stop reading about polls. You know, it feels like in the run-up to every 2 years' elections, all we read is article after article after article about this poll and this poll and this poll, until finally we're just sort of sick and tired of it.
We get to read a lot of polls about how people think elections are going to go, but now, Mark, polling isn't over, unfortunately. Now we get to read all the polls about how people think the election went.
Right, which is in some ways even more annoying than having to read all the polls before the elections, is having to read them afterwards. But I was struck by one poll that was published recently in the last little bit by the University of Georgia that seemed to suggest that everything was just peachy keen in the state of Georgia when it came to voting in the 2022 midterm elections. And I have to say, Paige, it struck me, even by standards of polls that are not useful, as useless.
Yeah, this poll was really weird because it said that 99% of Georgia voters saw no issues voting in 2022, when we know that there were issues, and we know that some people didn't even get to the polls because of these issues.
Yeah, so let's start with the basics, and I don't want to get into too much polling methodology, but it's a survey of about 1,200 people who voted in 2022. Well, of course, the people who voted felt like voting went okay for them because they voted, but this wasn't a poll of the people who waited in line and walked away. This wasn't the poll of people who couldn't be able to vote because the voting rules were preventing them from it, and this wasn't a poll of people who had their eligibility challenged and couldn't vote at all.
We also tend to make the mistake that voter suppression laws affect all voters equally when we know that they don't. We know that there are specific demographics that are affected by these laws more than others. People who may have had no issue voting in 22 may not have been affected by any of these new voting laws at all and got to vote as they always did.
Right. And one of the groups that I worry most about, I mean, not just demographic groups, but generally the groups I worry about, are people who were not able to vote for one reason or another, either because the lines were too long and they walked away, or the lines were too long in 2020 and they didn't show up, or, you know, they weren't sure if they had the right ID and they didn't vote, or, as we saw in Georgia in particular, in 2021 and then again in 2022, voter challenges and people who just were like, you know what, if I'm going to be in the middle of a controversy, even if those challenges fail, if I'm going to be in the middle of a controversy, I just as soon not be a part of voting.
Voter challenges have become, Mark, a growing issue. We've seen more and more of them lately, but one of the biggest voter challenges happened almost 2 years ago in Georgia, and there is a major lawsuit about it, and it went to court this week.
Yeah, and it is one of the most important pieces of litigation, I think, that people need to pay attention to. It's really important that people pay attention to this particular case in Georgia that is happening right now, because it has the potential to set the tone and the rules for voter challenges in the years to come.
Let's get into this, but first let's clarify what is a voter challenge and what does it mean for someone to be challenged?
Right. So we oftentimes hear a lot of talk about voter purges, right? Voter purges is when the state or a county removes people from the rolls because the state or the county no longer believes that they are eligible to vote. So think of, for example, someone who dies. The state gets the death records, they remove that person from the rolls. So when a state does a large-scale removal of voters, particularly where you worry about safeguards, it is called a purge. When states get limited because federal law limits and state law limits how they purge. We have seen a resurgence of Republicans and conservatives essentially doing vigilante purges by having individual voters or individual citizens submit lists of names of people who they believe should be removed from the voting rolls. So think of these voter challenges as essentially the privatization of voter purges.
So voter purges are from the state. Voter challenges are a third party, a private individual saying, hey, I don't think that person is eligible to vote. Do they need proof?
Well, so this is the thing, Paige, is that different states have different rules. Some states, you can only challenge someone who you know. So you know that I moved out of your town. So you go to the local clerk and say, you know, Mark Elias is still on the rolls, but he should be removed. Some states don't allow it at all, but a growing list of Republican-controlled states are allowing individuals who have never met the people they're challenging. They don't know the people they're challenging. They're just submitting spreadsheets of names of people who they are challenging. And that's where the real trouble begins.
So I'm at the elections office. I have a phone book with me.
Do they still have phone books, Paige?
I think they exist online now, but let's pretend that I printed out a bunch of pages from a phone book with everyone.
I'm very proud of you.
Thank you, that I own a printer as a Gen Z.
You have both a printer and you know what a phone book is.
I'm ahead of the curve, or behind it, actually. So I'm at the elections office. I have my printed out phone book pages of everyone with the last name of M in my town. And I say, I don't think any of these people are eligible to vote. What happens to them?
What should happen is that they throw away your printed out list and they kick you out of the office and say, don't come back. And in many states, that is what would happen. Unfortunately, in too many states, they would take that list and they'd have to treat it seriously. They'd have to, in some places, send you a notice, and you'd have to explain to them or prove to them that you are eligible to vote. In other places, the county officials would have to do independent research and have to look those names up one by one. And unfortunately, Georgia is more in that second category than the first.
So we're seeing more and more voter challenges happen within the last few years after big elections, before runoffs. Historically, has this been an issue?
Yeah. So look, this has been a problem in our political system for a long time. And it will not surprise you, Paige, that smack dab in the middle of this has been the Republican Party. In 1981, the Republican Party, the National Republican Party, the Republican National Committee, to be precise, ran a ballot security effort, that they called it, in New Jersey. There was a close gubernatorial election. At that point, New Jersey was much more of a swing state than it is now. And the Republican Party ran what they called their National Ballot Security Task Force, which engaged in a whole variety of unsavory tactics. You know, some of it had to do with putting off-duty police officers at the polls, you know, carrying weapons, that kind of stuff. But one of the things was a voter caging operation where the party sent mail to communities of color in New Jersey. They targeted Black and Latino communities in New Jersey and sent them non-forwardable mail. So mail where the post office was instructed not to forward it onto a new address. And then any mail that came back to the RNC was then the subject of a challenge of all of those voters. Now, voter caging is illegal now in many states. It is a discredited practice. It is not a basis for submitting a lawful challenge. States are prohibited from using it as a method to do their own purges. But that's where this story sort of kicks off, Paige, in 1981. But it didn't end there. You know, in 1986, just a few years later, the Louisiana Republican Party, again, in conjunction with the Republican National Committee, did it again. And in this case, in a congressional election, an RNC staffer wrote an email that said, that claimed that this program would, quote, eliminate at least 60,000 to 80,000 folks from the rolls. So that, quote, if it's a close race, it could keep the black vote down considerably. That was 1986. In 2004, the Republican Party again used voter caging to compile a list of 35,000 black voters in Ohio to challenge. That was the presidential race. Ohio was, at that point, the ultimate swing state. It was the state that decided the election between George Bush and John Kerry. The margin there was 80,000 votes. And they did a caging operation. The Republicans did a caging operation to compile a list of 35,000 black voters.
So you had all of these voter challenges from the Republican Party over 20, 25 years. Did anyone stop them, or were they just allowed to keep doing it?
Well, so after the 1981 incident, the Republican National Committee was sued and entered into a consent decree. It was sued for violating the Voting Rights Act. Because the Republicans were caught red-handed when they were sued, they essentially said, we want to settle. Now, you might imagine how bad the evidence would have been for them that they immediately wanted to settle. And that settlement was put before a federal judge, and the federal judge turned it into an order. That is referred to as a consent decree, because it is when the two parties both consent to the judge ruling a certain way. And under the terms of this consent decree, the Republican Party was prohibited from engaging in Election Day monitoring and voter suppression activities, really initially for forever. It was modified a few times by the federal court to expand it because of those violations that the RNC had made. But unfortunately, it was eventually terminated in 2017. You oftentimes, Paige, see quotes in various articles about how the Republican National Committee is back in business. Well, this is the dirty side of the business that they're back in.
So we have this history, the Republican Party, groups affiliated with it, going into what could be close races and challenging thousands of voters, normally voters of color, and saying, we don't think they're eligible to vote, using shady practices to get that information. So that's 1981 in New Jersey, 2004 in Ohio, Louisiana. Let's fast forward to 2020 Georgia.
Yeah. So in 2020, there was a mass voter challenge. I believe it was the largest voter challenge, at least since the pre-civil rights era. So, you know, there may have been something earlier than 1965, but since 1965, it was the largest mass challenge of voters in the United States. And more than 360,000 Georgians had their voter eligibility challenged in connection with the runoff Senate elections for Georgia. As you recall, Paige, after 2020, there were two Senate seats undecided. John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, they went into runoff elections that were held in January of 2021. And in advance of that, the Republican Party and groups associated with the Republican Party, conservative organizations, lodged 364,000 voter challenges.
And that's all within a few weeks. This is the time between the general election and the runoff election, right?
This is the time between the general election and the runoff election, which in and of itself, Paige, is actually pretty curious because it shows intentionality, right? This wasn't a program they were running year in, year out, as bad as that would be. But here it was, the U.S. Senate was on the line. You had a prominent African-American minister, senior pastor at the church that Martin Luther King Jr. preached at. He's on the ballot for this very, very close Senate runoff, and all of a sudden this springs up.
So these voter challenges were lodged, 364,000 of them. Was there a centralized group behind it?
So the centralized group was an entity called True the Vote, which for many of our listeners, they will know True the Vote. True the Vote was involved in various voter suppression tactics over the years. They're based, Paige, guess where they're headquartered?
In the Lone Star State, the great state of Texas.
Yes. And for many years, they principally focused on Texas, which, you know, kind of also makes sense. But by 2020 and 2021, they had expanded their footprint significantly. And they were the sort of lead outfit of national prominence. But there were lots of local partners in this, too. There were lots of local Republican organizations and local committees that helped effectuate, as you might imagine, a challenge of 364,000 voters is quite the task.
It takes a bit of logistics to get those names and addresses. And these massive voter challenges weren't the only thing that True the Vote was doing in Georgia before the Senate runoff. They were recruiting, quote unquote, citizen watchdogs to watch voters return their ballots in drop boxes. They were offering $1 million reward to incentivize its supporters to find evidence of illegal voting. They had their hand in almost every bucket when it comes to shady voter suppression tactics.
Yeah, and Paige, you know, to also fast forward for a second to 2022, you know, we saw another group in 2022 monitor drop boxes. And they also apparently have a connection to True the Vote. But it shows most fundamentally, Paige, that if you don't tackle these problems when they come up, they don't go away in future years. It's not like if you let it happen in one election cycle, the vote suppressors will be satisfied 2 years, 4 years later. And that's why suing True the Vote was so important.
So let's talk about that lawsuit. Who's involved in it and what are they alleging?
So the lawsuit was filed by Fair Fight Action, which, as many people know, was founded originally by Stacey Abrams and really does tremendous work on the ground around voter suppression issues and turning out voters to vote. And they brought a lawsuit in Georgia along with a couple of voters who were targeted by these challenges and sued True the Vote to try to prevent this from happening again.
Mark, it's my understanding that Fair Fight challenged that True the Vote violated the Voting Rights Act. I think a lot of people tend to think the Voting Rights Act in terms of preclearance or redistricting, or when a state passes a law that very clearly makes it harder for people to vote. What is the Voting Rights Act role in situations like this?
So the Voting Rights Act has several provisions to it. You know, people oftentimes talk about how the Voting Rights Act was gutted. And what they really mean is that a section of the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, was struck down by the Supreme Court in Shelby County. That was a provision that prevented jurisdiction states with histories of voter discrimination from changing their voting laws without pre-approval or so-called pre-clearance by the Department of Justice or a federal court in Washington, D.C. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which, Paige, you and Democracy Docket have covered a lot, protects minority voting rights oftentimes in redistricting cases or in cases where they're intentionally targeted in voting laws. But there are other sections, and in this case, we're talking about Section 11B, which prevents voter harassment, voter intimidation, acts that prevent or intimidate voters from participating in the voting process.
Fair Fight gathered testimony from voters in Georgia talking about how they felt about True the Vote's actions. Many of them said that they found out they were challenged when their names and addresses were published online or in local newspapers, and they felt like they were targets for harassment because their personal information was out there. Another voter talked about how she was the only Hispanic person at a polling place, and she was challenged, and the only other voter who was challenged was a voter who was Asian, and everyone else at the polling place was white. And she talked about how she felt she was being targeted for her race, how she felt that she was being racially discriminated against. Other voters talked about how they found out that they were challenged when they went to the polls and they weren't given any information about what it meant to be challenged or what they needed to do. And I think one of the most compelling quotes a voter gave under testimony was that they said, "I wonder if it is even worth trying to vote again, given the trouble that the voter challenge has caused me."
Right. And Paige, that goes back to what we were talking about at the top about this poll out of Georgia. Because that person who gave that heartbreaking testimony about whether it's even worth voting again, they're expressing the sentiment and telling the story of thousands and tens of thousands of voters or potential voters, non-voters, who don't want to be harassed to vote. They don't want to feel like they are unwelcome to vote. They don't want to wait in long lines to vote. And so if they feel like there is more danger than it's worth it, then they don't participate. And that poll doesn't pick that up. But the good news is, Paige, this case is proceeding forward. There were arguments recently, and I am thrilled to say the Department of Justice participated in those as an amicus, which means a friend of the court. They submitted a brief to support the interpretation of the law that the plaintiffs brought. In full disclosure, my law firm represents Fair Fight Action in that case. So the DOJ was asked by the court if they wanted to express views, and they took the opportunity to do so. And that is incredibly helpful. And hopefully this will make the difference. You know, when DOJ speaks, they speak not just as a regular party, but they speak as an authoritative voice on the law, on federal law, and they speak on behalf of the U.S. government.
Mike, so there's this long history of voter challenges being used to target voters of color in potentially close races. It causes people confusion. They don't know if they're able to vote. If voters have said that it makes them feel intimidated. You would think that because these voter challenges are causing all these issues, Georgia lawmakers might say, we need to do something about this.
Oh, did they ever? But it's not, Paige, what you would think that they would do.
So, Mark, you're saying Georgia lawmakers didn't make it harder to do any voter challenges or somehow make the process easier on voters if they are?
No. The Georgia legislature, I think, learned a different lesson, Paige, than the one that you and I might have hoped they did. Yet one of the ways those challenges in 2020 and 2021 were defeated, and to be clear, the vast, overwhelming, nearly all of those challenges were defeated, was by counties simply ignoring them. You know, some counties were sued to prevent those challenges from being effectuated. But a lot of the counties looked at these lists and were just like, this is garbage. We're simply not going to honor these challenges. We're going to move forward and hold the elections as we were. So in the face of that, you might think the Georgia legislature would think it has a problem in too many mass challenges and it would make mass challenging illegal. But instead, they targeted those counties and they passed a new law as part of the mass voter suppression bill, SB 202, that mandates counties adjudicate those challenges and actually punishes counties if they don't. So essentially, the law got changed in Georgia to make mass challenging easy, but dismissing mass challenges or ignoring mass challenges harder. So that's what the legislature did, Paige. It's very Texan of them.
Speaking of Texas, because everything is bigger in Texas, Mark, if I understand correctly, this change in SB 202 also made it so that someone could challenge an unlimited number of voters.
That's right. So one of the arguments that the counties in 2020 and 2021 used is that these challenges can't be these like massive lists. Like you can't, you know, voters can challenge a person here or a person there, but they can't do mass challenges. And the law then was enacted to clarify, as the Republicans would say, that, oh, no, you can do mass challenges. you can challenge an unlimited number of people.
Mike, the way that True the Vote gathered up all this information for their voter challenges in 2020 was that they looked at the USPS's National Change of Address database, where someone said, I need my mail forwarded. But that database doesn't give any reason or the length of time why someone could need their mail forwarded. So they could still be a registered voter in Georgia, but they're temporarily out of state for work or taking care of a family member or something like that. So True the Vote's challenges didn't need real hard proof. Did SB 202 at least change that standard to say you need proof or evidence as to why you're challenging a voter?
So first of all, Paige, it's worth noting that that method of challenging is the more modern computer age version of the caging operations that I was describing earlier from the 1980s. In the 1980s, the way you effectuated the same thing was physically by sending mail postcards that were non-forwardable. And then if they came back as non-deliverable, then it was essentially in that database. At that point, these databases were not publicly available. So in some respects, it's a more modern version of the same technique. But Georgia law didn't really specify what the way to prove a voter challenge. It liberalized voter challenges, and it said that counties have to have hearings on voter challenges, but it didn't really provide a threshold floor of what those challenges are. So you saw everything from challenges that didn't provide any reasons to NCOA data challenges to people looking on, Zillow or other moving apps or databases to see if people have if there are places for rent or for sale. I mean, it was just kind of like we saw challenges based on Facebook profiles and social media posts. So it was a hodgepodge in 2022, and that's, I think, by design. You know, the state of Georgia can't run a purge using NCOA data as the sole basis for a purge. But one of the problems with the growing trend of vigilante voter suppression is that private parties can oftentimes engage in tactics that the states themselves specifically can't engage in because of previous federal laws.
So how did this fare for the 2022 elections? Did we see mass voter challenges in 2022 for the midterms like we saw in 2020?
We did. We didn't see as many, but we saw probably about 100,000, maybe a little bit more challenges. And it had kind of a couple of effects. The first is it really, really tied up a number of the counties, particularly some of the larger counties where these mass challenges were coming through. Because now all of a sudden the counties were obligated to hold hearings and send out notices. And, you know, Paige, this is at their busiest time, right? They're getting these challenges in election season, in election years, when they have a million other things they need to be doing and communicating around voters. And so that was one of the impacts. Obviously, there were some voters who were challenged, and those challenges were upheld under this new standard. And those folks were removed from the rolls and faced a greater obstacle to vote in Georgia if they were able to at all. But I want to come back to what we've touched on a couple of times here. The psychological effect it has on voters. You know, think about, Paige, those voters who testified in the True the Vote case. You know, if you are new to a community, you know, you're a young voter who just moved someplace, or a college voter is there temporarily, or you're a minority voter where you are, you know, in a county that where you really are a minority in the community, it can feel very unwelcoming. And not only unwelcoming, it can feel threatening. And when you're reading that in neighboring Florida, Ron DeSantis is raiding people and having them arrested for, you know, things they actually are not crimes, for a lot of voters, they're just like, what's the point? Why is it really worth it? And I think when you look at the voter turnout numbers in Georgia and around the country, Buried in the good news of Democrats winning is some really troubling news about how voter suppression is discouraging certain people, certain categories of people from participating in the process.
True the Vote isn't the end of the story for voter purges and third-party voter intimidation tactics in Georgia or across the United States. We saw a rise in voter challenges before 2022 from a variety of organizations in states like Pennsylvania, Arizona, Iowa, Wisconsin. And True the Vote itself is still going strong. They're not backing down. They're standing by their intimidation tactics.
Yeah, Paige, as I mentioned earlier, we saw people with guns and body armor staking out drop boxes in Arizona.
We did. If you'll remember, for our listeners, in the lead up to the midterm election, when people in Maricopa County went to drop off their ballots in drop boxes, they were met by armed watchers who said that they were just trying to make sure that they followed the law. And like in Georgia, we saw voters in Arizona say that they felt incredibly intimidated by being greeted by an armed stranger asking them what they were doing when they were just trying to return their ballots for themselves or their family members. And we found out recently that there is a connection of True the Vote to the Arizona armed vigilantes. The Arizona watchers, quote unquote, were a part of this group called Clean Elections USA. Like in Georgia, they were also sued for intimidating voters. A journalist at VoteBeat reported that True the Vote has connections to Clean Elections USA. They are actually providing the legal team for Melody Jennings, the founder of Clean Elections USA, in these intimidation suits where plaintiffs are alleging that Melody and Clean Elections violated the Voting Rights Act and intimidated voters.
Yeah, there is a constellation of right-wing groups that are attacking our democracy and voting rights. And we all too often segment them or isolate them in our minds as, oh, this is the group that did this here, or this is the group that is challenging that, or this is the group that is supporting the insurrectionists, when in fact, Paige, more often than not, they connect up.
All tied by a common thread of believing in the big lie, believing that the 2020 election was somehow stolen and that it is up to them to right a historical wrong.
Yep, and I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. But here's the good news. The litigation in Georgia continues. There were hearings on the motions for summary judgment recently, and we'll see how that turns out. I mean, the fact is DOJ weighing in that case, as I said earlier, is really important. But we're not going to give up. And eventually, I have confidence that the courts are going to do what is necessary in this case, as they have in others, to ensure that democracy is protected and that the vote suppressors don't win. You can find out more about this case and read all of the relevant case documents at democracydocket.com. The case name is Fair Fight versus True the Vote. Thanks for listening to Defending Democracy. To find out more and stay up to date on the latest voting rights, elections, and democracy news, visit democracydocket.com and subscribe to our free daily and weekly newsletters. We'll see you next time. Today's episode was produced by Paige Moskowitz, Alexa Rothenberg, and Sophie Feldman. It was edited by Paige Moskowitz with help from Sophie Feldman. Defending Democracy is a production of Democracy Docket, LLC.